my big crazy prediction is that more people will make money or make a living playing games in the next 5 years than work in, you know, pick a big industry, the auto industry, global auto industry.
Hello and welcome to Crazy Till It's Not, a podcast about big ideas. Every episode, we bring on a guest to tell us a prediction for the future, which on the face of it sounds a little bit crazy. I am your host, Michael Stothart, an investor at First Minute Capital, and I'm very excited today to have Robbie Young from Animoca Brands. They are a blockchain gaming company that make a lot of games, some of which I was playing last night. But Robbie, could you please give us just a little intro about yourself and Animoca? And also, could you just tell us what is a blockchain gaming company?
No problem. Nice to be here, Michael. Thank you. So I'm Robbie Young, and Animoca Brands is a blockchain game company. We make a variety of different games through our studios around the world, games you might know and love, like The Sandbox or F1 Delta Time or MotoGP Ignition, etc. And we also have a very active investing initiative. So we're a big strategic investor. We're actually one of the most active across Web3, and we have invested in around 340 companies across the sector at various stages, although we're mostly an early stage investor. And blockchain games, I guess to put it succinctly, are games. It's the intersection of games and blockchain. So what happens is, you know, in a traditional game, you over the last 10 or 15 years, the gaming industry has coalesced around this idea of a free-to-play model. And in a free-to-play model, you basically buy in-game currency, and you spend that in-game currency to buy digital stuff in your game. And this digital stuff could be cosmetics, it could be, you know, swords or cars or turbochargers or digital stuff that allows you to enhance your game experience as either upgrades or personalizations. And that's how game companies have made money in games for a long time. And now that we have blockchain, we have a way to essentially give digital property rights to those gamers. So you can actually own the stuff in games. One of the things about games that people often don't realize is that they don't actually own the stuff in the games. They just rent them. So when you spend money in a typical game, you're spending money to buy things, but you can't do anything except use them in the one single way that the developer intends you to use it. You know, you can use the sword to go and kill stuff or something like that, but you can't give it to another player. You can't sell it. You can't bring it to another game. You don't really own it. You're just renting it. With blockchain now, you can actually own your digital stuff. So what we do is we make the in-game currency into what we call a fungible token, and we make the in-game items into non-fungible tokens or NFTs. And so as a result, you can take all those in-game items and you can always, you know, bring them into other games, or you can sell them in marketplaces, and you can have essentially agency over your digital stuff.
Right. That makes total sense. So can you tell us your big, crazy prediction for gaming, the world? What have you come on here to say?
So my big crazy prediction, which hopefully by the end of our conversation might not sound so crazy, my big crazy prediction is that more people will make money or make a living playing games in the next 5 years than work in, you know, pick a big industry, the auto industry, global auto industry, something that we associate with, you know, big, heavy industry and lots of people. I think more people will make money actually and make a living playing games.
So let me get this right. So there'll be more people making a living from playing video games than from making cars. This is your prediction.
Hands down. Yes.
Well, that is totally wild. And I'm excited to talk about this. Before we go into the futuristic bit of this and what's going to happen in the next few years, can you walk us through just a little bit? And you've done the bit of it already, but can you walk us through a bit of the history of kind of making money from games? Because obviously there's esports, there's like professional gamers who people enjoy to watch and win big competitions. But there's also always been a sort of semi-underground economy in like stuff for games. And I remember stories in the 2000s about you know, people working really, really hard to get a sort of sword in, you know, World of Warcraft, or actually maybe World of Warcraft wasn't out, but, you know, to get a sword in some game, and then they would, that was their job. And then they would sell it on to some rich person, often in the West, who didn't want to spend 30 hours trying to get the sword because it was, you know, a slightly painful thing to do. So this has kind of existed for a while. Like, can you tell us a bit about, like, where this started and so where we are now?
Sure. So I think as long as we've had, particularly MMOs, massive multiplayer online games, games where you have very enthusiastic fans who spend hours and hours and hours playing and building big online communities and spending, frankly, a lot of time in virtual space, just, you know, what do you want to call it? Forming online communities and having friendships and spending their time there. And what happens in these games is that people spend a lot of money, obviously, playing. But because these games are built on, as I mentioned before, free-to-play economies, where the goal of the game is often to acquire stuff. You know, you have to build out your land or build up your armies in order to achieve some strategic end in the game. Then the accumulation of this stuff is important. And so as a result, gray markets for this kind of content have arisen naturally because players demanded it. So actually, your example of World of Warcraft is spot on, because one aspect of World of Warcraft that became infamous is what they called gold farming, which is people working in the game to earn gold, and then gold could be, this is in-game gold, which could be then used for other purposes. And so what would happen is that, particularly in China, lots of players who had time to play the game would play and earn lots of gold and then sell this gold on eBay and other places against the terms and conditions of the game developer themselves, terms of service of the game, and sell it on the gray market to other players. It was a little bit of a kludge because they, you know, they had to do workarounds, they had to create a new account and sell them the old account login ID and stuff because there was no legitimate way to do this. So what we're doing now in blockchain games is essentially providing the infrastructure for this to be done in a proper way. Because from our perspective, we don't see, you know, we're not just developers, we're gamers too. And we don't see why gamers shouldn't have the right to be able to own their own stuff in games. And so once you own something, then everything that goes along with property rights should hold true. You should be able to sell it. You should be able to trade it. You should be able to take it and, you know, destroy it. Do what you want with it. It's your stuff. And so that's kind of the evolution of where this idea of, you know, why would you want to own the stuff in games comes from. Now, you also pointed to the second major sort of constituency of making money in games, which is esports. And I think esports is undergoing kind of a seismic shift now thanks to blockchain, because esports traditionally, you know, you've made money in games as an esports athlete, largely from sponsorship. And so what happens with sponsorship is that, you know, you're a great player of the game and you're playing, and you get lots of viewership on Twitch or other streaming platforms. And so you're able to attract sponsors to sponsor your play because you're essentially a linear TV broadcaster at that point in time creating content. But that's not an industry that's really accessible to everybody because it requires you to be able to attract a sponsor, engage them, perhaps live in a geography where there are attractive demographics to advertisers who are willing to pay, or even have professional management. There's a whole infrastructure around being able to attain that professional status. So it's not for everybody. If you are a standalone gamer who just happens to be really good but lives in a developing country, for example, those options may not be open to you. But in the world of blockchain gaming, they are, because since the financial infrastructure, thanks to Web3, is built into the game, that means that you can actually just compete in the game for prize money, for example. So we create in-game tournaments, for example, in many of our games, most of our games. And when you win the tournament, very simply, you win the prize pool and it goes into your blockchain wallet, and that's it. you don't need to be sponsored. You don't, you know, you just need to win. And it's about skill.
Yeah, super interesting. But when we're talking about a kind of seismic shift in like labor markets and kind of things that you could classify as work and a job, we're not talking about esports. That's the very top end. Mm-hmm. We're talking about kind of ordinary people just anywhere in the world mm-hmm. who can make some money from these games. So you talk about the auto industry. How many, can we just like get some figures on the table?
Sure.
How many gamers are there in the world? It's like 3 billion-ish, I think. Anyway, how many?
Yeah, 3.5 to 4, something like that.
3.5 to 4 billion. So it's like half the world-ish.
Yeah.
People who have played games. How many play-to-earn gamers are there? Like how many active accounts? Again, I read kind of so, 3 million-ish, but maybe that's...
Yeah, so that's about right. And right now, I think the number of blockchain wallets to begin with is probably about 30 million. I would have said maybe half of those are playing games actively. So it's a relatively small market at the moment.
And then how many people work in the auto industry?
About as many as play all blockchain games at the moment. So maybe 8 or 9 million, something like that.
8 or 9 million. Yeah. So there's around 3 or 4 million blockchain game players.
Yes. So there's probably about 15 million active wallets, and I'd say active players a little bit less, just below 10 actively playing, and then people who are making a living at the moment. I think at the beginning of this year it was about 2 million, maybe a little bit less now, because some of it is dependent on the market conditions.
Right, so there are about 2 million people making a living from gaming now-ish. Auto industry jobs, 9, 10 million. So it has to 5x.
Yes.
Which is actually not that much. Can you tell us what's going to drive this growth?
Like, sure.
Why do people want this? Why is it attractive?
Sure. So I think there's a couple... You got several different factors at play here. On the one hand, for sure... This blockchain and game industry is, you know, on a very strong growth trajectory, because I think that, you know, in our view, first, we call it blockchain games at the moment. But if we're sitting here 5 years from now, we won't use the word blockchain because it will just be part of the plumbing of games. So all games will be blockchain games in 5 years. Similar to, you know, if we were sitting here 10 years ago, we would have talked about online games, but we no longer use the word online because it's taken for granted that all games are online. So it, as I said, becomes part of the plumbing. I think that, you know, this will grow because more and more users will continue coming onto blockchain, and this will become the de facto model of gaming. And also what will happen is that as these games and these game experiences mature, the economies upon which they're based also will mature. And so what we've seen so far in what we're calling the play and earn space or play to earn space is essentially the sort of fine balance between two different player constituencies. And these are two constituencies that we've seen throughout the history of gaming, of free-to-play gaming, which are gamers that have lots of money and not so much time, and gamers that have lots of time but not much money. And, you know, to stereotype, often those are older players and younger players. So we associate young students with lots of time and not so much money, and working professionals with more money and less time. And when you can bring them together harmoniously in a game economy, they can benefit each other because they each have a resource the other one needs. And so that's what we try to do throughout our game economies, is put those two groups together for mutual benefit.
Do people, like, is it fun to play on the kind of working side of it? I mean, when I was we talked about World of Warcraft, and I used to play some World of Warcraft when I was younger, and I do remember kind of slaving away trying to like level up my, you know, character. Mm-hmm. You know, it's like killing lots of wolves in some forest for hours and hours. And I remember thinking to myself, like, why am I? I mean, I wasn't doing it to sell it. I was doing it because I wanted to level up my character. But I do remember thinking, like, why am I doing this? Like, this is such a grind. This is totally miserable. Like, what am I doing with my life? Like, isn't it a bit of a sort of miserable, it doesn't have the potential to be a bit of a miserable thing.
I think you've pretty much just described everybody's job. So I think, you know, whether you're talking about somebody sitting in an office or you're talking to Lewis Hamilton, you know, some days are better than others, to be honest. And the same thing is true with games, because the way games are designed is there's typically a kind of a parabolic difficulty curve, because games are supposed to be easy to get into and very hard to master, because otherwise everybody would finish the game, you know, immediately. So there is a certain point at which, yes, you know, you have to have mad skills, as they say, to be able to level up, and you got to spend a lot of time in the forest battling wolves. And that's what separates, you know, the more advanced players from the less advanced players. Let's get to the economics part. So say you're battling those wolves. If you were the young student grinder spending hours and hours battling the wolves to finally get past that level, once you did, you would unlock the achievement of getting whatever, the magic sword, right? So in an in-game economy where you can actually own your merchandise, then you can take that sword and sell it to the time-poor executive who can afford to buy it from you and doesn't have time to sit and battle wolves for hours on end. He just takes your magic sword and lops off a few heads and moves on. And hence the in-game economy.
Is there a tension, though, between the economics of these games and, like, making them actually fun?
I think there's always a tension between how to make a game fun. Fun is a very, very subjective quality. And so I think that there's always a tension between difficulty and, you know, satisfaction. And I think that that's something that, like you with the wolf battling example, right? Once you got past the wolves, I'm sure you felt great. And honestly, the harder it was, assuming you get past it, the more satisfaction you feel. So there is that question, though, of just how hard to make it. Is it, you know, 1 hour of your time, 2 hours of your time, 3 hours of your time, right? A little bit like exercise, right? So marathons make you feel really good, but you don't want to do one every day. So I think there is, you're right, always that healthy tension.
I did definitely think, why are they making me kill these wolves? Like, this is an annoying game feature. But I suppose it's the same way that Candy Crush is annoying by design, until you, because it's the you get the release, you know.
Yes.
They make the game, it's hard, and then you win, and then you feel great, and that's obviously part of the reason, right?
Yes, definitely.
I suppose my question with the tension between the economics and making it fun.
Mm-hmm.
Just want to, like, dig one level deeper into this.
Sure.
Because it strikes me that, like, creating a, like monetary economics,
mm-hmm,
is difficult.
Mm-hmm.
And making a really fun video game is difficult. Like, making a game that's really great, but where the economics also works,
mm-hmm,
strikes me as marrying two hard skill sets. And I know that's kind of what you guys do, and that's, mm-hmm, sort of the art of it.
Mm-hmm.
But like, is that a worry? Like, where are the tensions? Where are the, like, spots where that creaks?
So I think, firstly, our main job is to try to make a game enjoyable to play, because if it's not enjoyable, there's no reason to be there. So that's the fundamental premise. The second part is, when you think about creating that in-game economy, one of the opportunities and one of the major challenges of doing so in a blockchain game, as apart from a quote-unquote traditional game, is that we cannot control the economy absolutely. So in a traditional game, game balance is something you hear game designers talk about all the time. So being able to have, you know, the right amount of in-game items that are available, ones of certain rarity and power, and ones that are more common, and, you know, the amount of coins you can earn, and then how much you can spend. And all of this in-game economy is very, very minutely architected, with the exception of the fact that it's based on a hyperinflationary system. So it's minutely controlled, except that it looks a lot like Venezuela, you know. And so the challenge for game developers when they think about creating an economy in a blockchain game is removing themselves from that mindset that they need to try to control everything, because you can't. Once you have an economy where players can actually own their own items and trade them amongst each other, then it's much more like a real economy. It is a real economy. And so all you can do is, like in a real economy, apply certain levers to it, similar to, you know, a central bank raising interest rates or something like that, where you can give the economy a nudge in certain directions, but it's up to the participants in the economy ultimately to determine where it goes. So there is going to be more chaos as a result, which is not necessarily a bad thing, because what we try to do in a blockchain game is to encourage economic activity. It's not a It's not a linear process of us just selling things to customers, right? That's how traditional games work. We make our money because we sell you stuff, and that it's a one-way street. Whereas in a blockchain game, it's about generating GDP or economic activity in the game, and we levy a transaction fee on the economic activity for providing the game environment. And so, you know, we just want to encourage economic activity. Some of that will be us selling stuff. When you first come into the game, you buy stuff from us, maybe. Or you might buy stuff from another player to play the game. We don't control that. We don't try to push you one way or the other, because we generate a fee off of all the economic activity. So I don't care whether you buy it from me or you buy it from another player. I just want you to come in and have a good time and transact. And that's the main incentive.
Yeah, interesting. Has the, with the kind of crisis and crisis, with the collapse and lots of crypto prices this year, mm-hmm. has the kind of shine come off this model in some way? I mean, I've seen more criticism of, I mean, every single thing in crypto, obviously, but but of Axie Infinity, yes. you know, which is the kind of first mover, you know, mm-hmm. superstar of this of mm-hmm. this play to earn model, and maybe you could describe what sure. they do actually for people that don't know. But I've seen sort of more criticism of them. You know, lots of people in Indonesia who mm-hmm. quit their jobs and were making five times mm-hmm. what they were making before, and it was, you know, kind of amazing. And then now these tokens aren't worth anything, and it seems less amazing. Like, can you talk a little bit about that?
Sure.
And also, like, you know, what the sort of short-term crypto crash means for this?
Sure. So I think a couple of things. Number one, obviously, the macroeconomic environment has an impact on everything. And, you know, even in the blockchain sector, the macroeconomic environment of the price of cryptocurrencies has an impact on our industry, even though we're entertainment and we're largely, you know, usually counter-cyclical from, you know, economic downturns. I think to go back to Axie Infinity first, Axie Infinity is the poster child for success in blockchain games. It's been, by any metric, the most successful blockchain game so far. And I think one thing that's important, you know, to look at is how successful the game has been over its lifetime. And so the game began in 2018, I believe, originally, and then hit a huge wave of momentum in the middle of 2021. It just, about a year ago, took off. It was successful before, but it went into the stratosphere, so that by August of last year, it was turning over $1 billion of trading volume per month. And so I think what happened was that because of that unusually outsized success, people started to think that perhaps that was a new standard, at least for that product. And so when it fell back down to earth, people forgot that actually, if you look at a 2-year chart of transaction volume in the game, it's kind of back to where it was before. You know, it's not that something's gone wrong. It's that something went unusually right for a period of time, which was fueled, I think, by tremendous interest, not just in blockchain games, but in the wider crypto market in general.
Can you just describe what the game, what you do in,
sure,
in the game?
So the game is basically a collecting and battling game. So what you do is you have little cute characters called axes. These axes battle with each other, and they can also breed with each other to create more axes. And the more axes you have, the more you can battle and you can win battles. And there is an in-game economy where you can win tokens as a result. And so these axes are NFTs, and they're desirable in-game items. And so they have a value on the secondary market. So the more battling and breeding you can do to get more axes, then the more you can also sell or use to generate more axes. And so what happened was, around this time last year, a friend of ours who lives in the Philippines started, basically he observed a phenomenon that was going on in the Philippines. So he had taught his kids how to play Axie Infinity several months, I guess around Christmas earlier that year, between 2020 and 2021. And his kids were quite successful at it, and they were making, you know, $30-$35 a week, if I remember correctly, just generating new in-game axes and then selling them to other players who were coming into the game. And so he looked around at his local community, which in Manila had been shut down because of COVID. So they had a big COVID lockdown. And he realized that all his neighbors were out of work because they were in their homes. And he thought to himself, he said, why, you know, wouldn't it be possible for me to show them how to play this game just like I did with my kids? And maybe they can make some money too. You know, it would be at least helpful for them while they're locked up at home. So that's exactly what he did. But he ran into a problem, because in order to play the game, you need to have the Axie characters to start with. And the more popular the game had become, the more expensive those characters had become. So the cost of entry into the game had gone up. And, you know, at its peak, it was probably $400 to be able to participate in the game, because the cost of the characters was so high. Because there's a fixed supply. You have to earn them in the game. So only so many players battling every day generate so many characters. And so what he did was he created software, which we now call Guild Software. And what this software did was allow him to take his substantial collection of in-game axes and rent them to other players. And so he would rent them to those players, and they would use them, they would earn money in the game from playing, and then they would pay him a small rental fee. And so this was, this turned out to be a huge innovation in the industry, and I think kind of a hallmark of why I find blockchain gaming as an industry so exciting, because he created this innovation on top of the existing, already successful Axie Infinity game. It was not something that he had to do with the partnership and cooperation of Sky Mavis, who's the developer of Axie Infinity. He could do this completely independently, because these are open and composable assets. And so he could build this innovation on top of the Axie NFTs. And as a result, we now actually have dozens and dozens of guilds around the world that employ, you know, hundreds of people, actually thousands of people at this point, playing games in various play-to-earn games.
But all of these, but all of these people creating these guilds and like really innovating in gaming and making a living from these games are now making less of a living from these games, right? Because because the price of these cryptos has gone down.
Correct. So people earning money specifically in Axie Infinity now earn less money because the value of the in-game characters has gone down. So I think that that is, but that's not necessarily a criticism to levy on the model of what's going on in blockchain gaming and play-to-earn gaming. I think it's just a general macroeconomic factor. Just like somebody who's a property agent makes less money selling houses when the value of houses go down. And so I think that this is unfortunately just part of the trickle-down problems we have when the overall economy is sluggish. I do think What you see, though, is now you see the guild model extending throughout the blockchain game industry. So Axie Infinity is no longer the only game in town, meaning people who now have joined guilds are playing many, many different kinds of games. And there's a huge cottage industry in play and earn games that's arisen in the wake of Axie Infinity, because developers now see the opportunity to create these kind of games and leverage the power of guilds. Because guilds actually are a wonderful adjunct to player bases in games, because they're essentially groups of professional players. And when you think about the kind of constituencies that you want to have as a developer in a game, you want to have a really healthy economy, and you want to have a diverse player base. So you want to have amateur players, you want to have professional players, you want to have everybody in there. And so guilds are a great way for us as developers to onboard large groups of professional players who are good at playing the games.
So we're talking about this move from a few million people now mm-hmm. to 10 million, more than the auto industry in not mm-hmm. very long. But eventually, you're saying it's basically going to be just all games. Like, that just yes. will be gaming. So that's, we're moving to 3-4 billion people who have played play to earn games.
Yes.
My two kind of criticisms or kind of downsides to this that I'd like to put to you. One is the kind of gig economy, like, nature of this and of the types of jobs that sort of get created. I mean, on the one hand, there's the example of that town in Manila who didn't have jobs because of COVID, and then did have jobs because they could play Axie, and that's obviously great. Mm-hmm. There might be other examples of people who have really horrible jobs, like hard manufacturing jobs that are really bad for their backs, yes. and they have bad backs, and it's much better for them to have the choice to be able to do something online, as lots of people in the West do jobs that's basically sending emails and clicking buttons online.
That would be us.
Exactly, that would be us. So on the one hand, you know, why shouldn't people have another job that they can do? But on the other hand, there is, and lots of the newspaper articles about this world kind of focus on this, there is like a slightly dystopian world of, you know, thousands of people in these kind of gaming sweatshops doing the equivalent of gold mining and like not really like they're like the like sum total of good to humanity, you know, compared to, I don't know, mm-hmm. mining or manufacturing things. You know, you could argue sure. it was a bit less. Do you see what I mean? Like, is there a bit of that makes you feel, at the nastier end of it, like anything in the gig economy, makes yep. you feel a bit like potentially queasy? And is there a way to, you know, does that get regulated? Is there a way to stop that? I don't know. What do you think?
So I think, first of all, I don't think there's anything wrong with online work. And I think it's, frankly, as you alluded to, a lot better from a health and safety standpoint than many other types of physical labor. So I think it's nice that it gives people options. And I think that the important thing to focus on here is that this will be making a living for some people. And for other people, it will be supplementing their income, because it will be a way for them, just like you have people who may drive for Uber at the weekends because they enjoy driving and they make a little bit of extra money doing it. But it becomes something that is not the primary focus of their life, but a part of it. And I think that what we're talking about here is a spectrum of people making money in games. And so at one end, you have people who will make their living from this firmly because a new business model has arisen where they can spend 8 hours a day and do this instead of doing something else. And they will choose to do this because it's a preferable option, because they make more money, or because it's safer, or because maybe childcare is difficult, and so they can do it from home with their kids, and rather than having to go to an office or something. It gives people flexibility. I think that at the other end of the spectrum, you have people who really don't need necessarily to be making any money in games, but will do so anyway because that's going to be the business model of games. And so I think it's important to look at this whole spectrum, because when we think about what games mean today, we've actually gotten away a little bit from what games were like. This is when I'm going to sound like an old fart. When I was young. So when games used to just be on console, originally, we had cartridges and CDs and DVDs, etc. There was a really fundamental idea, which was when you got tired of your game, you could take your game somewhere and you could sell it. And there was a secondhand market for games. And hence, you know, Games Workshop and GameStop and all these physical retailers arose because the idea of recycling your secondhand stuff was just something we took for granted. And so when the world moved to downloadable content, and because the internet was never really designed to secure digital copyright or digital rights management built into it, we didn't have a way to essentially secure that digital content. So instead, we just said, oh, well, you have to pay for it, but, you know, that's it. If you want it, you have to buy another copy. You can't sell it to somebody else or anything, because we can't protect copyright. We can't prove where it came from. So basically, you just rent it. You don't own it anymore. And that's patently unfair to consumers, in my view. You know, why shouldn't we be able to spend, you know, we spend £50 or $50 on some piece of content. Why don't we own it? Why don't we have the ability to sell it to somebody else secondhand and recycle it? Maybe just because we're tired. We don't want to play this game anymore. We want to move on and play another game. Or do I just put, you know, do I have this closet of digital stuff that just accumulates over time and is a sunk cost? I think that's actually unfair to consumers. So what we're hoping is that with this new business model, we can essentially unlock a lot of that value in all this digital stuff that we have. And at the same time, it also helps new players coming into the system, because now all of a sudden, just like in the old days, you could, you know, go and buy a secondhand cartridge at the Games Workshop for less money. Now people who can't afford the initial cost of some of these digital items can buy secondhand ones for less money and also enjoy the play experience. So I think this, the impact of essentially the, not just the financialization of games, because honestly, they've been financialized for decades already, but the turning over of what used to be gray market economies into legitimate economies for the benefit of players, I think is going to be nothing but a net positive for the gaming community.
All right, that's a good answer. So my second criticism,
go for it,
or worry, is that, and we touched on it a bit earlier, but is that these games actually become less fun,
mm-hmm,
because the game developers put more focus on basically like the economy of like trying to, it's so, there's so much profit,
mm-hmm,
out there if you get the economics of these games right, that it's kind of more hacking my brainstem and less giving me like something that I really like.
Sure.
So it's like, you know, if I'm playing like Red Dead Redemption, you know, I've paid whatever, £70,
mm-hmm,
for this game, and it's expensive, but I've paid for basically a 50-hour movie that has been beautifully scripted and crafted, and the whole purpose of it,
yes,
is to make me love it.
Yes.
And with games that, I mean, particularly in the like free-to-play model,
mm-hmm,
you know, like I play free-to-play games sometimes, but you know that the whole point of them,
mm-hmm,
is to get you to, you know, spend that 25p to skip the level in Candy Crush or whatever it is. And it doesn't mean they're not popular.
Yep.
And it doesn't mean that they're not successful. But I feel that it does mean that they're less, like, good in some kind of inherent sense of sort of quality. In the,
sure,
in that they're targeting something else. And, like, does this move to play to earn give you more games? There'll be a range, and if it's all video games, there'll be good ones and bad ones. But does it give, like, more of this sort of, you know what I'm saying?
Sure. So I think the best way to look at this is to think about free-to-play. The business model of gaming, when you have an ownership economy that's owned by the, like, a player-owned economy, is completely different. So the business model of free-to-play and traditional games, because they're based on walled gardens, is the fundamental idea is we bring in users, so we spend lots of money on user acquisition, we have a big user acquisition funnel, you bring all the players into the game, and you keep them in the game for as long as humanly possible. And usually, especially in mobile, most of them churn out in the first day, and then we have what we call, you know, day one, day seven retention, day 30 retention is how long we can keep a player in the game playing. And this is really critical, mainly for the reason that we can only make money from them for as long as they're there, and we make money selling them stuff. And so we try to keep everybody there because statistically, the longer they're there, the more likely they are to buy something. And so the focus of the design of the game and the gameplay is attract the people and keep them there as long as possible so that they buy something. In a blockchain game, it's different because we want them there so that they buy something. But because of the way that NFTs are created, NFTs are created with smart contracts that encode the digital rights management in them, so the royalty system. So if I sell a player an NFT sword that they can play with, if they take that sword and go to another game and leave my game, but that sword then gets sold on a secondary market, I can still make a commission, which is basically my royalty right of being the original creator of that sword. And so I benefit financially from the value of that sword, even if it leaves my ecosystem, which means I don't have a financial incentive to try to lock people into my ecosystem. It doesn't matter anymore. And so when I lose that incentive, then I can actually just try to promote people having as much community and commerce as possible. And this is a key point, because what makes, and we've seen this over and over, what makes blockchain game economies successful is community, building online communities. So I would say, when you think about the money that you spend, you know, if you compare that £70 you spent on Red Dead, right? The best way to think about it in a blockchain game sense is think of it like membership. So why would you want to pay a membership fee to join a club? Once a month, you pay that dues to join a club. Because the fun part is not that you have 50 hours of playtime. The fun part is, you know, when you go there, you're going to have an enjoyable experience, and all your friends who you enjoy those experiences with will also be there. You'll be part of a community because you like playing with other people. You like transacting with other people. So the allure for you to keep spending money in this community is because you enjoy being part of the community. And hopefully the success for both you from enjoyment standpoint and us as a developer is that actually you're going to spend a lot more than 50 hours, because your time spent is not based on my linear storytelling ability. It's based on you meeting other people. And frankly, other people's company is much more entertaining than anything I could ever script for you.
Yeah. I spent yesterday playing The Sandbox. It's really fun.
Good.
What games are you excited about?
What games am I excited about?
I mean, you have such a ridiculously massive, colossal portfolio. It's probably hard to choose. But what's coming up?
Coming up, the exciting ones. Phantom Galaxies, if you like transforming robots a la Gundam or, you know, Transformers, etc. And if you like space, so then transforming robots in space, pick up a copy of Phantom Galaxies.
Sign me up.
And so I think that's very exciting. It's actually the first AAA blockchain game, so I think it's of a visual fidelity that you'll find quite engaging. Along the same lines, we have a game called Life Beyond from our French studio called Darewise. And I think this is also, again, another AAA sort of MMO experience, both of which are available on PC and web. And so those are the two exciting launches over this time period, this month. And then next month, we'll be having content from MotoGP. So that will be exciting because, you know, for me, at least personally, I'm a big motorsports fan. And so this is our first foray into two-wheeled motorsports as opposed to four-wheeled motorsports. So I'm quite excited about that.
Fantastic. And finally, how was NYC NFT? What was the vibe?
It was electric, I think, is the word that most people used, I have to say. You know, we had a great event for all our investee companies. We had sent out invites to about 250 people of all the companies that we invested in, plus our own staff and people like that. A lot of them, you know, meeting for the first time again because, you know, of COVID. A lot of people still haven't met in person. And we had 700 people show up at the door to come into this event. And this was an afternoon, you know, 2 to 5 o'clock in the afternoon event. This was not like people showing up for free drinks at a party.
Did you let them in?
We couldn't, the fire marshal had something to say about that. But the thing was, it's just because everybody is so positive in our industry about what they're building and about what the meaning that they think their product will have in the future. I mean, obviously, people think they're going to make revenue from their products. People think they're going to give users incredible experiences. There's just so much creative energy and excitement that it actually flies a little bit in the face of the overall macroeconomic picture when people are talking about tech stocks being down and et cetera, et cetera. So it was very encouraging.
But the basic point is that if you can build a community,
yes,
that's a real value, then it really works. Just like if you can build a game that's actually fun. If it's not fun, it's a multi-level marketing scheme where you're relying on the next
Correct.
Person to bring in money. If it is fun, then it's not, and you're creating real value.
Absolutely.
And that's the fun thing about the community, is that everyone there wants to, well, not everyone, but, you know, the good people there are enthused about creating these communities, right? And that happens whether the markets are up or down, those communities exist.
Yes, and if you think about the real landmark games in history, you know, whether it's Dungeons and Dragons or Grand Theft Auto or, you know, League of Legends, World of Warcraft, all these big games that are sort of super games, they're all about community. They're all about communities of players who are passionate enough to go to Comic-Con or to dress up as their favorite characters because they have passion about being members of communities that have a shared experience and shared interest. And so blockchain games tap into exactly the same thing. All we do, hopefully, is make it much more fair to the consumer because we actually give them ownership of their digital stuff.
Fantastic. Well, you've made me want to dig out my World of Warcraft character that I spent so long shooting dragons and wolves for. But thank you so much for joining us, Robbie.
No problem.
I think we've learned that actually the idea of more people making a living from playing video games than the auto industry is not as crazy as it sounds. Or at least it's crazy until it's not.
Exactly. I think the future will be here very soon.
Thank you so much for being here. Thank you.
Thank you.
Great.
Good now?
Oh, you're really fun.
Okay, good.
Yeah?
Yeah.
Is that right?
Yeah, it's fine.